When you want Wayne to come here, did you bring your graduate students with you
today? Yeah. I left a few back there, the ones that were pretty far along, and some of them that had family ties or something that they felt that they couldn't do that. But I brought 10 graduate students with me to Maryland here, and then left 4 or 5 back there. I commuted back and forth until they finished up. And then a few that would have worked for me then shifted and worked for somebody else if they were just starting.
Did you do any polymer courses there?
Yeah.
You developed,
yeah. I taught an advanced course in the organic chemistry of polymers.
That was probably some of the first ones. I don't imagine there were too many courses like that in existence in '50.
Well, not so many. Although I mentioned, you know, when I was at Illinois, half of one semester of advanced organic was polymers. So that was really wasn't as long as the one I taught at Wayne, but it was a nice short course in polymers. That was my first introduction, so obviously I took that material and then used that as the nucleus of the course that I taught. And there were some books and things that were coming out at that time that could serve as a basis for that. So,
I have some other questions I'll come back to later in terms of polymer education. But for the time being, now let's go back to your early years here. In 53, I think I have the date right, you synthesized the first all-trans diene polymer. Now, had that been of interest since you made the all-cis in 48?
Well, that was, of course, obviously, we wanted to complete the thing, and there was certainly an interest in that at that time. Then we got so we could make either all cis or all trans in various ways, and then when the Ziegler catalyst came out, we were put out of business because it was easier to make the all cis and all trans materials with the Ziegler catalyst rather than our method. Right.
In 1955, you were appointed to the ACS Committee Advisory to the Chemical Corps.
Right.
And I know very little about that committee. And
well, I guess it's no longer in existence, but the ACS had a long-standing arrangement with the Chemical Corps, and there were quite a few of the people that felt that the ACS should be getting more involved in advising the government in various ways, and so this was not just an ordinary advisory committee set up by the Chemical Corps, but it was through the ACS, and there were a lot of people that had been involved in chemical warfare, certainly through World War II, that were on that committee and were quite, you know, quite familiar with the workings of that. So
I think Price was chairman of the committee, wasn't he?
I think that was right. And some of the people at Johnstone at Illinois was an influential member, and Morris Garage was on there, and so there were quite a few both academic and per case. Frolic was on that committee with me, and so there were quite a few that that were involved in that.
How long did you serve on that committee?
I don't know. It must have been 4 or 5 years. Through that committee, of course, and the knowledge I'd picked up, it was interesting that Morris Garage started a little program where he talked to General Stubbs into funding some young chemists around the country to do just fundamental work on anything they wanted to. And so he recruited guys like Overberger and Beckelheide and myself and Hiskey in North Carolina and a number of people like that, that where he just gave us some money and said, work on anything that you think is related to chemical warfare. And so a lot of the stuff that I did there on phosphorus came out of that thing. It was very fundamental work. And,
how much money was involved with this program?
Well, it wasn't a large amount of money, but what they did do was assign some Army personnel here on the at Maryland that were drafted during the Korean War, and instead of doing their fighting in Korea or being on active duty in the Edgewood up here, they were assigned to these universities. And one of the guys that I had was Shelley Buckler, who is now director of research at Polaroid. So he got his PhD with Chavis Walling at Columbia, and then was drafted and assigned here. So it was ideal duty for him, and so he did his postdoc here.
I'd never heard of that program. That's interesting. What, in terms of your service on the committee, what were your experiences? And anything specific that you remember about the?
Well, we essentially what we were supposed to do is to review their research effort. And so we'd meet several times a year up at Edgewood, and somebody would sort of present their overall view of what they were trying to do, and we'd give them some advice. And it was on wide-ranging topics, some of them were overlapped what I knew, but then there was somebody there that was always knew something about the science involved, so it was always interesting to see the interplay of a bunch of people outside, essentially unpaid consultants, so it's a little different than consulting with a company where they pay you to do something, but many of these people had a lot of experience with chemical warfare problems, and so it was interesting to make suggestions on approaches and things like this that might be good.
Did you get to see any demonstrations of some of the things the Chemical Corps was doing?
Well, just on a rare occasion we would get something demonstrated, but obviously you really can't see real demonstrations. We could see how fast you could kill a rabbit with a nerve gas, and that was always amazing. You just take one drop and put it on the rabbit's skin, and he was gone almost immediately. And then we did see a few munition type things, but not any what you call large scale demonstrations or anything like that. So no real field tests of that type.
So the chemical warfare materials, it was still a pretty active project at that time.
Yeah, that's right. All right.
Is it the same time of the early 50s when you were here that you synthesized the first ladder polymer?
Mm-hmm.
How did that develop?
Well, of course, this was an offshoot of our ester pyrolysis, and one of the first things that we were always trying to do was to make Diels-Alder polymers. So we wanted to make a difunctional diene and then react it with a difunctional dienophile. And it was Jimmy Economy, who is now director of polymer research at IBM, and I guess he's the immediate past president or chairman of the polymer division, and also. The previous winner of the ACS Award in Applied Polymer Chemistry, just before I was. And,
that's interesting.
And so he made the vinyl butadiene. Well, again, that was a small molecule that no one had ever been able to make before. And so, again, we were trying to synthesize unusual but important compounds. And so vinyl butadiene was one of those that fit into that category. And he was able to make that. Then we can treat that with some cyclic dienophiles. So if you do that with say quinone, you get a nice ladder polymer, and so then we've gone on to make a whole bunch of other bifunctional dienes and other bifunctional bisdienophiles, and so we made a whole series of perfect ladders and very few other ladder polymers. Does anybody really know anything about the structure? But ours are one of the few that are made by unequivocal methods and that are reasonably perfect ladders.
When did you get into doing protein analogs? How did this
develop? I guess we were worrying about some important small molecules, and we wanted to make some very active amino acid derivative. So we started with lysine, and tried to see if we could make some very active little monomers from that, and so one that we aimed for was the glycine azide hydrobromide. And again, that was a very highly reactive, very small molecule that no one had ever been able to make before. So when we were successful with that, then we just sort of just branched out. So that's led us in many different directions, making polypeptides and ordered copolyamides, and then the biodegradable polyamides. All those follow from that one initial discovery.
I guess in most recent years, most of your work has been in the area of either, what should I call it, expanding or non-contracting polymers.
Well, that's been one that's got the most publicity. Certainly our work on free radical ring opening and our biodegradable things are both our current interest and have certainly attracted a lot of attention. But certainly our work on the monomers that expand is certainly one of the one that has a lot of potential use and application. So from that point, it's attracted a lot of attention both from academia and in industry.
And I guess the idea of whether a polymer, whether it be expansion or contraction or polymerization was known, but were you the first to achieve the expansion?
Yeah, we were the first to achieve expansion. The closest anyone had really come to that is Tobolsky. Pointed out that ring opening polymerization had lower contraction than ordinary polymerizations, but he never really carried it all the way through. He pointed out this correlation, but all his still contracted. We took his observation and said, well, if we can find monomers that where we open two rings for every new one that's formed, then we should have a chance for expansion. And when you look for examples of in the literature, there weren't any, so essentially what we had to do is to invent a new type of polymerization. And that's our multiple ring opening polymerization. And so that was the key to the concept then.
And how did you select your target molecules?
Well, we just hunted for highly reactive intermediates that had a chance of undergoing double ring opening. And so the first one we tried was these pyroorthoesters. And that was successful. And then we went on to the ketal lactones, and then the trioxybicyclooctanes, and then the pyroorthocarbonates.
There was just something in Sandy News a few weeks ago about the Epilin Corporation.
Yeah. That story was not quite accurate. I'm a minority stockholder in that company, and really have nothing to do with the day-to-day operation of it. What happens is I do have a patent, just an American patent on the monomers that expand. The university has a patent policy that anything discovered at in the university belongs to the university, and else they release the rights back to the inventor. And the university has this arrangement with the research corporation.
Yeah.
And they looked at it and, after we'd done some research for a year and decided that we hadn't carried it far enough to, so that they were at least interested in it. So they released the rights back to me, and so I filed, and I claimed very broad claims, and but it took 10 years to get the patent, and claims aren't quite as broad as I started out, but they're still pretty broad, and so that issued in 83, and so it still has 14 years to run. So we had a contract with the Armored Ballistic Missile Command to do work on some spiroorthocarbonates for use as rocket motor casings, and we developed some, you know, pretty attractive materials, and they wanted to do some testing, so they needed 50 pounds. Well, I wasn't about to synthesize 50 pounds, so they put an RFP on this, and Murray Cohen, who has this little consulting lab up in Newark, bid on it and got the contract, so he made 50 pounds of the material. And then he became intrigued with the compounds, and then decided he would like to form a little company.
I see.
So essentially what I did was I gave him an option on the patent, and then so he formed this little Epilin, and so as part of the arrangements, I own 2% of the company, but that they will pay me a royalty on everything that they produce. And so he's floating a $2 million stock issue as soon as the SEC approves the sale. So that's what they're waiting on now.
I see.
Yeah. So anyway, I haven't spent very much of the money yet.
In connection with this, you said that the ring opening work has perhaps more fundamental possibilities. You do have a paper on some dental filling.
Well, that's right, and that's an offshoot of this expansion. So we did some joint research with the dental school up here in Maryland, Van Thompson up there, and I did some joint research, and he evaluated some of these things, and they look interesting. And he stopped his work and went to dental school because he figures as long as he's going to be a professor in the dental school, he should have a dental degree. So he has his PhD in material science and now a dental degree, and so we're talking about going back and doing some more joint research, and he's spending a year at the National Bureau of Standards, so that we'll have a student that's working for me out there, and so we'll get together this summer and for the next year do some additional research in that field. The only trouble with that is it takes an awful long bit of testing before they'll let you put something like that in somebody's mouth. But it does look attractive for that. Usually fillings, the material that they put in is this GMA, which is a big, big bismuth acrylate, and it shrinks about 6.5% by itself. And if you put it in some other monomers, you may get 9% shrinkage. Well, if you go in to have a filling put in, it pulls away from the tooth, and bacteria can get in between the filling and the tooth then, and enlarge the cavity, and your filling falls out after 2-3 years. And we think we can solve that that problem.
I think I remember reading that the adhesion characteristics are very good. On the enamel surface.
Well, all these things that expand turn out to be super adhesives. It's, we had predicted that from in the property of ice. You know, when water freezes, it expands by 4%. And as a consequence, ice will adhere to anything. So, like an icicle will form off your eavesdrop, and you break it, and it will never go away from the eavesdrop. It'll break the icicle, so you'll get a cohesive failure, but you won't get an adhesive failure. And early in the airplane industry, some guy got the idea of a way to prevent ice from forming on wings of airplanes was to put a Teflon coating on the wings. The idea that since water doesn't wet Teflon, the ice would form and just fall off. But that doesn't happen. It sticks better to Teflon than it does to aluminum. And so you don't solve that. So we had predicted that these monomers would be very good adhesives, and we can increase the adhesion of polymethylmeth acrylate to aluminum by a factor of 40. So we're one of the things that Epilin wants to exploit is coatings and adhesives that depend on the strong adhesive property of the expanding monomers.
Are there many other materials that have this type of property?
None other. There's some inorganic materials. I mean, water has that thing, and some of the amalgam fillings will expand a little bit. And precision type is made with alloys that will expand a little bit. But there are no other monomers except this.
Is there any competition in this area? Any other people looking at?
Well, there's a whole bunch of Japanese companies and things like this that are looking at it. And a lot of the, you know, American companies are evaluating it. And Westinghouse, for instance, I have a little joint research with them. They're interested in the electrical properties. And it's very, very good for that because we're producing void pre-materials. And most electrical breakdown is across cracks and voids. And since we're producing void-free materials, this has some potentially good electrical properties.
I have a statement that you may or may not want to comment on, but which summarizes a number of the things we've been talking about here. This is a quote from, I think, one of the award nominations. Bailey's work starts with fundamental concepts, continues with experimental artistry, and winds up with results of great practical value.
Well, I hope that's true.
At this point, let's turn to some of your other activities. You were president of the ACS in 1975.
Right.
What did you see were the important issues 10 years ago? And why did you pursue that particular position?
Well, of course, I'd been active in the ACS for a long time prior to that, so that wasn't in a vacuum. Of course, I had been involved in within the ACS, of course, in changing a lot of things within the structure of the ACS that I didn't like. One of the things that that I didn't like is how difficult it was for somebody to work their way up in the superstructure. So, for instance, I was on the council for years and years, and never got appointed to a committee. So I ran for the council nominations and elections committee and got elected.